Hello there, this is Nina and we are here for the Audible Weed Walk number 26. Hope you had a happy Pongal, Sankranti, Lohri, Bohag Bihu and all the other names I'm missing. What did you make at home? I had made Patishapta, which is a special, very mildly sweet, kind of a crepe filled with coconut and kheer, which is the, you know, thickened milk. But I kind of made my own twist. I made it only with coconut milk and not with milk, etc. And when I shared this information with a friend, she told that there is something very similar in Kerala called Madakasan. Amazing, isn't it? That you hold the link to food, to true culture, and you find such diversity and amazing similarities across the subcontinent. I'll come back to Pongal a bit later, to this festivity and what it really means. Remember, a few weeks back, I spoke about Shinrin Yoku, or the forest bathing. Not everyone has the access to forest, you see, but everyone has access to weeds in the Emilu. A walk with attention to the periphery, where these plants are growing wild, will surely reap the same benefit as forest bathing, irrespective of whether you have reached the comfort or enthusiasm level of an ardent weeder. Weeder, is that a new term? It's new for me too. Weeders are foragers with a focus on weeds or the uncultivated greens. I don't know if I have coined it, but it sounds that quite right. Let's explore how foraging affects us, both as individual, which we often touch upon, but us as a society. How has it influenced us thus far? Considering that agriculture is only 10,000 years old, foraging, which is part of the hunter-gatherer way of life, is major interest for the anthropologists. It seems wars have occurred in greater intensity and frequency since humans have settled, or they have started settled agriculture. So, naturally the question comes to mind, is foraging society more peaceful than food producers? A workshop sponsored by the U.S. National Institute of Child Health and Human Development that involved 27 scholars in 2002 explored that. They have widely agreed that compared to food producers, hunter-gatherers, which includes the foragers, if you call them, fight less. But why? Perhaps it's because, in contrast to food producers, foragers are less prone to resource unpredictability, famines, and food shortages, suggest some scholars. Resource unpredictability is a major predictor of increased warfare. How were they able to deal with resource unpredictability? Well, they were able to perhaps deal better because they were aligned to the seasonality, like the seasonal available wild food source, both plants and animals. Also, you know, if the food sources kind of change, they adapted. This adaptability, you know, gives you a resilience. Also found some curious facts about this, about intake of plants and animals in the diet in the hunter-gatherer or forager societies. It seems closer a place to the equator, the higher the effective temperature, naturally, right? And therefore, more plant biomass. Pretty simple. So, hunter-gatherer society that are closer to the equator depend more on gathering than hunting or fishing. Interesting, isn't it? Which means traditional communities around the equator eat more greens than those that are, you know, in the other latitude and altitudes. Actually, if you think about it, that's what kind of matches what you see and observe. Another paper commented the finding and commented on the finding and concluded that lower the effective temperature, the more hunter-gatherers rely on fishing. Now, I do not know why this particular paper was focusing on fishing, or if the fishing includes fishing and hunting. I don't know. It talked about fishing, so that's what I tell you. As the growing season lengthens, the hunter-gatherers are more likely to be fully nomadic. Interesting take on population too. As foragers become nomads, their groups or clans remain small, and so does their population. A fledgling society can be, in comparison, more settled and therefore increase in numbers. Wow, I hadn't thought it like that. In New Guinea, foragers with high dependency on fishing tend to have higher population densities and larger settlements. Some of the foragers in the New Guinea with high dependency on fishing have densities of 40 or more people per square kilometer, which is very high compared to other foragers and nomadic groups. In a number of ways, childhood in hunter-gatherer societies appear to be more relaxed and easygoing compared to most food producers, and hunter-gatherer children appear to receive more warmth and affection from their parents. Now, coming back to the population, well, most foragers lived by moving frequently and making temporary encampments. They might have repeated seasonal movement based on, you know, some animal migration or some kind of fruit ripening. Like, you know, you see the animals move, you know, there is marula fruit and all animals kind of gather around the marula, or there is Kulinia fruiting in the Western Ghats, so the lantern macaques, you know, kind of gather up there. Foragers usually live in small groups of 15 to 30 and split up even further when food became scarce or some conflict arose. Population grew extremely slowly, if at all. Mothers' milk were the source of sustenance for the children, and so the females nursed for a long time, 3 to 4 years sometimes, that prevented new pregnancy. In any case, mothers could not carry more than one infant at a time, so the population remained low. In these close-knit groups, foragers usually shared the food they accumulated, especially prices of fresh meat. Apparently, forager society were the most egalitarian in human history. You know, even when the population settled, the groups of people who are closer to this history in terms of time, like, you know, they are not so far away from this kind of life, still practices some of this sharing. I remember going to very remote areas of Cameroon where there was a hunt. You know, somebody went and hunted in the village, and the whole village was kind of excited, we thought, and we wondered why, and turned out to be that whoever hunts, it doesn't matter. Sometimes they go, you know, collectively to hunt, but even otherwise, even if one person has gone and hunted, he would share what he got with the rest of the community. That's amazing. It seems foraging has also influenced our festivities. There are festivals dedicated to wild edible greens in Urla in Turkey, called currently it is called Slow Food Urla. I have made a mental note for a place to visit. It's in my list. Actually, a few years back, on invitation by a physicist turned award-winning chef, Aditya Raghavan, we had gone, accompanied him in a small group, to a trip to Nagaland. It was a foodie trip. We had a plethora of wild greens and forage food there. All of them were amazing, simply cooked, flavorful, hot but not spicy still, subtle and wonderful. But talking about travel and ethical foraging, I was wondering, you know, foraging when it is kind of outsourced to others, can really be unsustainable. You know, forest honeys in our shelves in the supermarket, is that really sustainable? I mean, come on. What are the tribal people who used to have this forest honey are currently having sugar, refined sugar? And that's what often, commercialization does. So I was thinking, how one can address that? Perhaps, one way would be that during the travel, if one actually participates in the foraging, one gets to, bring back some honey or, whatever they wish to when they visit back at home. So this is something like very similar to a CSA experience I had, community-supported agriculture. I was a student and was part of a CSA. And as part of that arrangement, it was told that if we participate 8 hours of work in the farm, then the cost of the CSA that we need to pay were much substantially lesser, because the farmer really wanted people to engage in the farming activity, in the actually growing food and picking fruit and packing them. So I think foraging should be something like that, that if you really want your bottle of honey and want to take it back to your city, then you must participate in the foraging, and the foraged food will primarily be for the people who are staying there, who are from the community, rather than for sales. Well, these are kind of radical ideas right now, because that's not what is happening. The wild uncultivated greens have several benefits. They allow us to adapt to our environment and tune ourselves to the season, nature, and ourselves, and to our body. An environmental education paper from Romania concluded that environmental knowledge contributes to the formation of a sound ecological thinking and moral judgment, hopefully also leading to a change in behavior and the formation of environmentally committed communities. It said that in order to bring its full potential, environmental education has to be considered not as a, co-curricular activity or a disparate discipline, but integrated and run throughout other disciplines and everyday life. This is so important. One of the reasons I plan to have a value-based transformative training on edible wild greens for teachers, educators, and enthusiasts when we have reprinted book one and in the process of publishing the remaining two in the series. Keep in tune. Now coming back to our own intake of food and wild food, this Pongal we recently had is not just a harvest festival, is it? It is the beginning of sun's movement to the north, beginning of the Uttarayan, or Adana Kala, at the end of Visarga Kala, or Dakshinayan. According to Ayurveda, seasons of the year is divided into six parts for the northern movement of the sun and six for the southern movement. And these actually are marked by the three seasons. So each season has 2 months. So 12 months. So now, right now, at the beginning of Adana, the body gains considerable strength. So food that one cannot digest so well in other times can be eaten now, provided we do not have the untimely rain continue. If so, we are back into the rainy season regime. In this period, if it is, dry, and remain dry like this, and it's towards the end part of the winter, this is the period to digest food that is fatty, salty, sweet, all are okay. But within that, to remain healthy and balanced. That is what Pongal represents, a brief period of good sleep, heavier food, and good health. Greens I saw this week and I recommend you to eat that are also in the book are Musumusukkai or Mukia Madaraspatana, included include the balloon vine in your soup or batter, dosa batter. Eat some adai, which is like dosa but not fermented. Wait a bit till you go full fermentation mode with kombucha, dosa, etc. for a few more days after the rain. Another green that you might consider including in your soup, rasam, or any other way you feel like eating is tuduvalai. But whichever way you choose, eat them cooked. More letter. Until then, stay well and stay safe.